Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today. Hello, it's Adrian from Sofeast here, and today Renaud and I are discussing just-in-time manufacturing. Now, there's been a lot of buzz about this topic because a lot of commentators are suggesting that JIT is really at risk of things like the coronavirus pandemic, the US-China trade war. So I want to get to the bottom of what this supply chain model is, how it is perhaps susceptible to external pressures, and what's next for companies who are pivoting away from it. Let's get started.
Hi, Renaud. Good to have you with me today.
Hey, Adrian.
Today's topic is JIT manufacturing. That's just-in-time manufacturing. Now, recently, there's been quite a lot of articles and people have been discussing what's going to happen post-coronavirus, if that's ever going to be a thing, hopefully. And one of the things that has been discussed is a possible pivot away from JIT. Now, this topic might be of interest to some of our listeners. So I just wanted to get your take on what you think the future is for JIT. Could you explain to me what is JIT manufacturing?
So let's take an extreme example. You have, I don't know, let's say you have a small restaurant and they just do, let's say, noodles, right? Let's say it's in China. And the customers go there, they order their bowl of noodles. It's just, let's say, two kinds of noodles and five kinds of toppings. And every morning, the lady goes to the local market, buys some extra vegetables and meat and so on, based on what inventory she still has from the day before. And she might go to the local supermarket to buy some extra noodles of, you know, her own, let's say, her own noodles provider. And then customers go there. She doesn't exactly know what they're going to order, right? So one day they might order a lot of a certain kind of noodles and not, you know, the extra thick, and then another day, a lot more extra thin, you know what it's like, right? Some of them might want a lot of beef, but then, you know, maybe there's a bus of Buddhist people who say, no meat. We just want the one with veggies and mushroom, right? Demand is unpredictable, but does it really matter that much? Not really to her. She might run out of inventory of something, and then maybe she tries to, maybe she sends someone to run to buy more of that quickly. And for a while she says, sorry, we don't have it. But she runs on a very low kind of inventory, and she doesn't bother with forecasts. She doesn't try to understand where the market is going and what is going to order from her, right? So that's an extreme example of a just-in-time supply chain, you know, pretty much. The customer is coming, they order, she makes it for them, so she doesn't have any finished goods inventory. She just has noodles before they are cooked and the toppings maybe before they are cooked and served. It depends, but she has very little inventory. People order, then she transforms and delivers to them in 5 to 10 minutes, right? And she doesn't have much inventory of all of these unprocessed goods because she goes back to purchase them to. To replenish her inventory every day, right? So that's not pure just in time, because pure just in time doesn't really exist in as long as atoms are involved. It's possible if you think of it in terms of bits, you know, if you want to create something that's purely digital, you might be able to make it without any inventory at all. just in time as I need it, I make it, right? But as long as atoms are involved, you're always going to need to have some inventory somewhere sitting. So the noodle shop is a case. It's pretty good, pretty close to just in time. And let's take the exact opposite, is a really long and complex supply chain. Maybe I remember there's a book that studied for a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, you know, how many countries the components come from and how long the supply chain is. It gets really amazing. There's also, let me see, what was that book? Was it Lean Thinking or Lean Solutions? I forgot, where the authors, Womack and Jones, look at the supply chain of the cans of Coke, right? I think they did some work with Tesco, consulting work, and then they studied that all the way from the iron ore mines in Australia to a place probably in Norway or Canada, someplace like that, where they do the smelting, where it's less expensive, and then, you know, it's sent somewhere else where it's rolled in coils, and then it's somewhere else where it's it's reprocessed again, and so on and so forth, until it reaches the bottling plant, and still, you know, and it's not consumed yet, so it still has to go into distribution centers, supermarkets, purchased, stored at home, and then finally consumed, and what happened after is yet another concern. But that's a really, really long supply chain, 18 months, if my memory is correct. You wouldn't think about that when you look at a can of Coke, right?
Definitely not. No.
It's insane. It's insane how much working capital is stuck right there. I mean, in some cases, you don't really have a choice. I remember one of my first jobs was in a manufacturer of cork for wine, and they have to let cork dry naturally. Maybe there's other processes that could make it dry faster and so on, but they were just letting it dry naturally in sort of the traditional way. And you can't do anything with it for, I forget, nearly a year or maybe more than a year, I forget. But that's a lot of working capital sitting there for nothing. And then if suddenly you lose half of your market share, well, maybe you're stuck with all of that and you need to find a way to reset it or whatever, right? Or if people stop drinking wine, then you're stuck with all this cork that you're going to have to, maybe it's premium cork, where you're going to have to set it at a discount for, I don't know, for decoration purposes and acoustic or thermic, also sort of isolation and so on, but it's much cheaper. So when you have a lot of inventory on your hands, it means a lot of working capital is really sitting on the floor. And working capital is not cheap. Very often companies that are not overly capitalized have to borrow working capital, you know, to at the tune of 7-10% a year or even more, depending on their risk profile. So it comes with extra cost, and it also comes with risk, as I mentioned in the case of Cork, because you sort of have to make your decisions based on the forecast of where the market is going. So to come back to fashion, the example of the pair of jeans, well, if you make a pair of jeans in a really cheap way and it's a relatively simple style and you know, just a four pocket pair of jeans, you make it in Dhaka in Bangladesh, so you get the cotton somewhere, and then, you know, you have to decide on how to dye it, in what color, and then you do the cutting and sewing, and then you ship it to the market. Well, all of that is not happening in 1 week, right? It's month. So what happens if the market shifts? Well, once again, if it's a very classic, simple four pocket kind of jeans with very classic color, no crazy or fancy treatment, no sandblasting, nothing special. Well, you know, what's the risk? The market is probably not going to move. So for this kind of product, a longer supply chain is not a killer. However, if it's a more of a designer gene, and then they have 8 seasons in a year, and you know, they really try to push the envelope. They try to get closer to sort of a Zara model, but they always have new styles coming up, and you know, fashion is a fast moving ground, and they never know if they're really going to hit the market at the right time with the right product. Well, the window is much shorter. If it's, say, in North America, they better have it made in Ecuador or Guatemala or someplace like that, that's much closer, or Mexico. There are some good factories making jeans for VF and some other big buyers over there, very close to the market. So can be made fast and delivered, you know, send a truck every 2 days out of the factory to the distribution centers in the US. And then when the stores give the signal that, hey, this style is not selling as well as last week, then they cut production in half. And then if the signal persists, they just stop it and get onto the next style. This is much, much safer. And it's usually a good trade-off actually to make these products at a unit cost of 15-20% higher. So three benefits. First, less working capital, as they say. The second one and the third one are really related to the traditional risks of having too much inventory in a supply chain that's way too long. So the second one is you're more responsive to the market. If it sells very well, you're going to give it more resources, you're going to make more of it, right? If you can decide that, okay, we're going to die for this color, for this style, and so on, and you can have it on the market 2.5 weeks later or 3 weeks later, that's much better than 2 months later, because you know, by that time, who knows if it's still going to be popular. You cannot really ramp it up aggressively.
Sure.
So you can really catch opportunities and make more money. And number three is, if it doesn't sell so well, you cut your losses faster, and you have a much lower risk of being stuck with a lot of styles that, you know, a lot of pieces that you have to dispose of in your cheaper market channel, in maybe at a discount and so on. And some people say, well, you know, you sell it at a discount, you still sell it, it's fine, there's still a little bit of margin or whatever. No, this is like scrap, you know, in a manufacturing facility, we call that scrap. Yeah, scrap still has some value, but it's scrap. You really don't aim for it, right? These are the three key benefits here. So to get back to your question of what is just in time, yeah, just in time means you have a need, a market need, and you can supply it just in time and make all the decisions behind the production and fulfillment as close as possible to the time of consumption. So it works quite well with a very short supply chain where everything is geographically co-located and the processing times are very short, right? If you look at, for example, Toyota and the Toyota production system, and which is really what people try to emulate when they say, oh, this is lean manufacturing. Well, Toyota looks at the markets and says, well, there's a big market in the US. It's really not good to send all these cars from Japan to the US. Let's start setting up plants there, right? And we don't want to, and then the second step is, we don't want to buy the parts from Japan and send them to the US to assemble the cars there. We want at least 90% of local suppliers. You know, and every year they worked on developing local suppliers. And in a good car factory, they don't have, 4 inventory turns a year. They don't have 10 inventory turns a year. They have many, many more, but they are in a very unique situation, is that they're so huge that their key suppliers, you know, the supplier of the seats and the supplier of the packaging and the supplier of this and this and that, they are basically co-located very often. So they would get some of the materials, you know, every 2 hours, every 4 hours. right? That's just in time. It means they don't have to manage a lot of inventory, and their suppliers don't have to manage a lot of inventory. It's all about the supply chain as a whole. You cannot say, oh yeah, we're just in time, but then you force your suppliers to keep a lot of inventory because they never know what you're going to order, right? Or your customers have to keep a lot of inventory because you push that into them because you give them, you know, a special deal and buy all of this from me, and then they are stuck with a lot of stuff for 6 months. Now, this is not just in time. This is not good, because all of this creates a lot of inefficiencies in the supply chain. So just in time has to be, it's at the supply chain level, right? It's not just at the level of one node in the supply chain. And it means close to market and fast response to market needs. That's what I would say.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess if it's at a supply chain level, as in it's an entire model, with circumstances like the coronavirus pandemic, perhaps that makes this kind of model a little bit susceptible to problems if something so widespread happens. I mean, is that the case? In your opinion, how has the pandemic, you know, hit this supply chain model and caused people running just-in-time manufacturing to have problems?
Yeah, good question. A lot of people raise that point, and it's a bit ridiculous because people very often say, "Oh yeah, we're trying to be just in time. We are just in time," but they just look at themselves. They don't look at their whole supply chain. And that's where a lot of these misunderstandings come from. For example, in there's a McKinsey study on several kinds of verticals. Let's say some supply chain are crazy, like pharmaceuticals, second tier supplier, 35 to 70 days, typically in China. First tier supplier in the EU or US, 120 to 140 days, assembly/packaging, 55 to 100 days, regional distribution centers, 80 to 90 days. These guys, I think they would never pretend to be just in time, right? And then if they were hit with, for example, the second tier supplier in China that is unable to produce, and they wait, and then they have that buffer, but after a while they run out. Are they going to say, "Oh, we are too just in time. We actually needed more inventory, just because things happen, and this one really hurt us"? Well, that's nonsense. You are hit because you have a long supply chain, and this always comes with risks. If you were making the base, whatever ingredients, I don't know how to call that in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, close to you, whatever happens in China is not going to impact you. You are less susceptible to be hit if all your eggs are in the same basket, actually. But if you put your eggs in 5 different baskets, and you actually need all of these eggs to make your omelets, it's much riskier. That's the way they should look at it. So a lot of people say, "Oh yeah, it's you know, we're too just in time. We need to have more stuff for just in case," which is the opposite of just in time. And I just don't agree with that. So yeah, a lot of people pretend that they are just in time, but again, if you look at the entire supply chain, they are often just the opposite. You know, they have some production activity far away from their market. That's very, very dangerous. You cannot have just in time if that's the case. You can, but you're going to do a lot of air freight and things like that. Think of what a company like Toyota would do. They would never want to do these kind of things, right? This is just not healthy. They know that. And companies need to keep this in mind, because yeah, if one day air traffic has to be stopped, you know, like a volcano blows up above Iceland, or you know, or something similar, hey, the air traffic is going to be impacted. That's just an example. And you're just adding risks on top of risks if you spread your manufacturing in many countries. So I'm not saying it's always possible to do everything in your own country, close to your market. There might not be any industrial base capable of doing that. Fully agree. You might have to make things long in advance because your manufacturing process just takes time. So in the case of the aluminum can, the Coke aluminum can, hey, all this stuff is not going to be made in a week, right? I mean, mining, smelting, rolling, and so on and so forth. If you could co-locate all these activities, or let's say it has to be mined in Australia, and let's say it is going to be sold in the UK. Well, maybe there's no mining there, you know, in the UK, and it really has to be mined in Australia, fine. But then can we just do all the transformation right there in Australia? It would bring the hood process from 18 months down to maybe 2 months. Who knows? If with some good thinking, maybe even shorter, probably shorter, right? And that would be more just-in-time thinking, right? And in that case, you're never going to get down to real just-in-time, because again, you're not going to mine it in central London. It's going to have to be brought from somewhere else, right?
Sure.
So when people say, this is just-in-time, you know, we really made a big mistake by going in that direction, just because the finance guys keep saying that inventory is expensive, we should have kept more inventory and so on. Well, don't blame just in time, okay? Blame your supply chain design. Blame your, basically the way you set up your whole supply chain. And it might not be your fault. You might be in it and you have nothing to do with the way it was structured. Maybe it's your customers. But don't, you know, maybe your whole supply chain needs to communicate better. Maybe your whole supply chain needs to plan better for what might go wrong and how to avoid it. And they might communicate about maybe some buffers somewhere that are necessary based on a good risk analysis, if that makes sense. But just saying, this is JIT and we really made a big mistake, sorry. I don't really agree with that.
Okay. And during the pandemic, well, we're still going through it, but I mean, during the peak of it, we definitely did see some companies suffering because they lacked components or finished goods coming in because of Chinese suppliers having to be closed down. You know, you've seen that effect actually happen. So would you say, you know, there's probably now little chance of being able to go back to that model? Or do you think eventually things will sort of get back to normal?
Okay, so first, I haven't seen much, you know, changes. However, when people cannot travel, and when there's so much uncertainty in the air, people don't make decisions. So people might be planning for a lot of moves, but are not doing them. So we don't really know what's in the pipe, what's going to happen once things sort of get back to normal, or people decide that, okay, it's really time to move ahead because we've been waiting for so long and actually we're not going back to anything normal. Who knows? So I think in the long run, smart companies are going to manage their risks better, and all the other companies that are not planning for the medium to long term are going to get back to, yes, this is a risky strategy, but everybody else is doing it in our industry, and this is how to cut our costs and blah 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 blah, and this is the way we know how to operate, And why should we make a change? Look, this is working now, you know, which has been the dominant model for many, many, you know, for most companies so far. I don't think this is going to change. I think this is still going to be the dominant model. I mean, I'm not defending it at all. It's a pity, but that's what I would expect. Now, so, I mean, a lot of companies have, you know, for example, board members saying, no, we cannot keep going like that. What is your plan? You know, requesting management to make some plans to get out of that, requesting a lot of changes. But again, it's still in planning. So I can't really comment on that because we don't know. We don't know. And if we have a very serious recession in a lot of developed countries, end of this year and maybe also next year, who knows? Well, all of that is going to be put aside and these companies are going to be worrying about short-term survival instead, right? There's a lot of flavor of the month sort of management trends, unfortunately. If things sort of get back to normal, sort of people get used to doing Zoom calls and not traveling so much and so on, but the economy recovers, are they going to make a lot of changes? Again, I would say 3% of companies are going to be very active. The other ones, it would depend. Also, American companies are more likely to be restructuring their supply chains just because of the geopolitical tensions, let's say, between the US and China. So this is also going to be a catalyst of changes. So I would guess US based companies will be leading the charge here. And a lot of other companies are going to observe. And they might actually find that American companies departing China will open more doors to them, with sometimes some good suppliers really desperate for business and willing to give them good deals. We've seen that over the past couple of years. So I can't really comment too much, you know, looking into the crystal ball. But if something happens, it's going to be US owned companies first. It will be out, away from China. However, does it mean that they're going to rush to Central America and Mexico and to reshore into the US? I'm not sure about that because it really used to a certain model of sourcing. And you can still keep using your procurement office in Shanghai or in Hong Kong for buying, you know, much more in Vietnam, in Indonesia, in Thailand, in India.
Sure.
However, you can't really use them to buy from Mexico. They are often going to tend to keep the same model, just, you know, trade, you know, go away from China and maybe go into Vietnam if they can find, they can still find some room there for themselves or to some other Asian countries. That's more of what we've seen so far. And I would expect more of the same. And that means long supply chains and that means no JIT. So let's see.
Interesting. Well, that's what it's all about. It's all about the crystal ball. So, I mean, you know, you have shed quite a lot of light on that. And yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the States as well, because while I was initially talking about coronavirus, you do have to take into account, you know, the effect on their sort of political policies and the US-China trade war as well, which is, you know, arguably, it's got more of an effect on their manufacturing than the coronavirus has had so far. So,
right.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That is.
Yeah, that's right. So with the election coming in, what, 2.5 months or slightly more in Washington, D.C., what's going to happen? I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty right now. So people are waiting. People are, waiting to see what happens, trying to conserve cash because they don't really know what they're going to do. Just focus on the operations, head down these days. Maybe plan ahead and talk a lot, but not do very much.
Yeah, fair enough. I get that. Well, when we know more, I'll be sure to get you back onto the podcast, and we'll talk about any developments that we see occurring with JIT and other important topics like this. And until next time, Renaud, thanks for filling us in about JIT.
Cool. Thanks, Adrian. Have a good one.
No worries. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to like and share, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other places that you get your podcasts from. See you next time.